From RTE Radio, I'm Níl Óshiarthán. This is Playback Daily.
When it comes to getting, you know, personal abuse, I don't like it, who likes that? I understand it too, because people are hurting.
My calendar remains a very interesting focal point in my kitchen, because it looks at me as empty as the day is long, saying, look at you, you fool. You thought I'd be full forever, didn't you?
Oh, your mum gave me a loan to get a nail gun because Mother's Day I had 30 to make and Easter I had another 50 to make.
Wow. Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily, it's time to ask who owns the legacy of Michael Collins, why you should employ a carpenter to do work for you, and it's Hopkins versus Burton, dawn of poetic justice. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that would surely win the Oscar for Best Radio Catch-Up Show if there was an Oscar for Best Radio Catch-Up Show, which there isn't, obviously, because the Academy of Motion... Let's go straight to what I'm stubbornly continuing to call Ryan Tuberty's musings. It's when he spends time musing on the news. Get it? And this morning, Ryan wasted no time getting stuck into a breakingnews.ie article on the things we've forgotten how to do.
Six things... Breakingnews.ie. Six things we have all forgotten to do during the lockdown. The one we mentioned here some time ago, which was small talk. We've forgotten how are you? Good. And yourself? Good. And yourself? Good. And yourself? Good. We're just two people in this conversation. And yet, repetitive asking of the how are you. And of course, in Ireland, we say I'm fine, which is shorthand for I've had the worst day in my life. I can't tell you just how bad it's been, but I'm not going to tell you that because I don't know you well enough, don't trust you, and I don't particularly like you. So I'm going to keep going now because I have to buy some bananas in the supermarket. See ya. Bye. Ireland, a conversation. I'm sure it's different elsewhere. It's just small talk. How are you today? Shocking or brilliant. Either way, we don't do small talk now like we used to. So we have to get back on the small talk bus. God help us all. Two, we've forgotten how to budget. Apparently budgeting has not ceased, for many quite the opposite, but the pandemic has tended to simplify things for better or for worse. So no spontaneous post-work pub trips, just about worth it, rail cards or luxury cruises to Hawaii. The balance sheets are shorter, so it's if not necessarily healthier. So that's what's happening there. We've also forgotten how to greet people because of the nature of it. We don't know how to shake hands, we don't know how to hug, we don't know what to do. Gosh, I met somebody the other day and I thought, didn't this person know very well? And my instinct reaction would be to go and say, go give them a hug and say, I forgot the first time in 18 months. I said, whoop, I was in the supermarket. I said, sorry, it's been a while. And I was only thinking that last week, I think I'm missing the handshake. I think I actually may be missing a handshake, which is a strange thing. Initially, I didn't mind it so much. I was always a fan of hand sanitizer, to be honest with you. Not necessarily as a germaphobe, but just as somebody who likes clean. And but I do think that the handshake is a nice icebreaker to say hello to somebody. And it just says, you know, there's something very basic about it, isn't it? It's quite nice. It's earthing. Anyway, the other thing a lot of people have forgotten too, and I don't include myself in this one, is dress properly. But that is, I think I've kept that ship afloat. But a lot of people clearly have. No one irons a shirt for their housemates. The pajamas on the bottom shirt on the top Zoom uniform now feels perfectly professional. Some people are happy even mid-meetings to chomp into a sandwich or get stuck into whatever meal they happen to have that they heated up from last night and destroying therein the microwave and people's peace, sense of smell around the kitchen. But nevertheless, that's something else. Forgot to dress properly. Forgotten how to dance. Not an issue for me. Can't dance, won't dance. Don't dance, but we have apparently. And finally, one thing we have forgotten in the middle of it all is we've forgotten how to plan. The first proper invite to a party, are we saying that right? Will be a surreal moment, and we expect sales of diaries to skyrocket. What are the odds if we promptly get double booked? Fair point. My calendar remains a very interesting focal point in my kitchen because it looks at me as empty as the day is long, saying, look at you, you fool. You thought I'd be full forever, didn't you? But you didn't count on this thing, did you? I said, no. So I find myself having a moment of reflection and then move on, get the milk out of the fridge and finish my coffee.
Wow, we nearly went to a very dark place there. But happily, we were rescued by the milk. But what about the legend that is Anthony Hopkins?
You know, Anthony Hopkins won the award for Best Actor at the Oscars. And he won one for Silence of the Lambs. Back in 1992, I think it was. And he wasn't there at the Oscars the other night because he was unavailable. He was 83 years old and he was unavailable. Now, I presume then people were going, wouldn't you think he'd have the courtesy to... Well, he's, and as the, so this article here by Susanna Goldsberg says, well, actually, he's 83, he didn't want to travel, he's vaccinated, but he doesn't have to travel, and strictly speaking, he probably shouldn't have. And as it turns out, anyway, Anthony Hopkins was doing what a lot of people, when they hit a certain age and they've lived abroad, do. They come home. And he was touring around Wales and right back to the source of where it all started. And in this article, I didn't realise he had a lovely, warm relationship with his own parents. Really, really lovely relationship with them. And he dedicated his Oscar in 1991. Sorry, that was the year, to his mother. She died after contracting a blood infection, aged 89. He dedicated the Oscar to her. And then, having lost his father 2 decades earlier, he also admitted that one of his first thoughts had been, oh, well, I'm going to be next. It's an extraordinary feeling. And that's what he was feeling when he posted to say, here I am in my homeland in Wales, and at 83 years of age, I didn't expect to get this award. I really didn't. And I'm grateful to the Academy, etc., etc. But he did at one stage, and I was intrigued to see this, that he went to see his father's tombstone, his grave. And at the grave, he quoted Dylan Thomas's poem, Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night. And this is the footage of that. Anthony Hopkins at his father's grave, probably in the last 3 or 4 days. And at the very end, it goes quiet because the camera in this piece, the phone, whatever it is, looks at his father's gravestone. But I think it's very touching. And actually, he can't go all the way with it because he's so moved. And at 83 years of age, the power of bonds and life and love and loss is very evident in this.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. The wise men at their end know dark is right. Because their words had fought. Oh God, I can't do it. It's painful.
Couldn't finish. Isn't that amazing? Very, very touching, I thought. And I thought also of Richard Burton, of course, would have been that sort of Dylan Thomas and that poem and that beautiful Welsh voice. And, you know, we spoke about even Tom Jones last week. There's a beautiful musicality, isn't there, to the Welsh tones. There was a big piece in the Irish Times on Saturday by Dennis Staunton. Great piece, a whole page on Welsh independence. I studied a little bit of Welsh history when I was in college, and Owen Glendower and this idea that they might be on the road to independence. This talk of a border poll in this country, that's for another day's work. But the United Kingdom possibly breaking up, and the state of the Cummings and Johnson row over in the UK at the moment. You know, things are fragile and febrile. There's no doubt about it. But as I say, that poem was beautiful. Anthony Hopkins, as I say, not being able to quite even finish it. But I thought it might be nice, just as we're riffing here on this subject, to hear the that gorgeous version of it, the Dylan Thomas poem, as I say, by Richard Burton.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night. Good men, the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight and learned too late they grieved it on its way. Do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men near death who see with blinding sight, blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
Wasn't expecting to hear that on Ryan Turberty's Newsings this morning. The great Richard Burton reciting Dylan Thomas's poem, Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night. Well, I fear Playback Daily is all downhill from here. A lot of this morning's Today with Clare Byrne was taking up the resignation of a backbench government TD. Clare got the scoop when Fine Gael TD for Dublin Bay South and former Housing Minister Owen Murphy spoke to her shortly after he made his resignation announcement.
How are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks very much for having me on this morning. Mixed emotions, I suppose. I mean, I've been a politician now for 12 years and it kind of defines you. It's how you kind of defined yourself. And a member of Fine Gael for 12 years, and to be stepping away from that is tough. It's a bit daunting, but I'm also excited about the future as well.
So what's happened today? Are you no longer a TD as you sit here?
I'm no longer a TD. I spoke to the Ken Corla last night. How it works in terms of the process is I have to write a letter to him to inform him officially, and that letter was given to his office this morning. So that's how it happens. Mm-hmm. And back to civilian life.
And are you a member of Fine Gael?
Still a member of Fine Gael and still committed to Fine Gael. That's not going to change.
Have you spoken to your party leader, Leo Varadkar?
I have, yeah. No, I spoke to him. I mean, to be fair to him and to everyone, there were certain people I was trying to keep in the loop as I was coming to this decision. So, I mean, and how I came to the decision might be worth explaining. I suppose most people know me as the Minister for Housing, but I've been a politician for 12 years. 12 incredible years, and it was incredible honour and a privilege to have that opportunity. But before I was in politics, I worked in international affairs and international arms control. And since Christmas, I've been reflecting on those 12 years, 10 years in the Dáil, 4 years as minister, and everything that I did. And like a lot of people, I suppose, because COVID gives us that time, I've been thinking about my future and where that might best be. Where can I best make my contribution now and next? And I decided that I wanted to get back into international politics.
Okay, so did you have those conversations with yourself prior to the election of last year?
No, absolutely not. No, I mean, this is something that has only kind of crystallised in my mind in the last kind of couple of months. And then something else happens. Its own logic takes over. So once I realised I want to go and do something else, you kind of realise, well, is it right to stay as a TD? Is it fair on anyone else? If I'm sitting here in Leinster House taking what is a very generous salary from the public purse, but I'm not 100% committed to it, is it right to, you know, be going into the Dáil next week and voting on things that affect so many people, knowing that I won't be held accountable for them at the next election? And once I answered those questions, I realised that the right thing to do, as I see it anyway, is to resign now, and that allows me the space to go and do this other work, but also it allows the constituency the chance to replace me and get someone new in at a very important time for Irish politics and Irish life.
Have you something lined up?
No, but it's something I'm very interested in doing. It's related to my degree, and it's something I've done before, and I think opportunities are going to be coming up. And it didn't sit with me to all of a sudden be sitting in my house or my office in Leinster House, you know, actually applying for jobs. So now I have the freedom to do that.
Mm-hmm. So you haven't been applying for jobs?
No.
So Leo Varadkar's statement this morning pays tribute to you, and he says he was aware for some time that you were considering your career options, although I'd hoped that he would stay in the Dáil, given his abilities, flair and talents. Clearly, you decided not to stay. But that seems to suggest that he was trying to influence your decision. He was trying to convince you to stay on. Is that right?
That's fair, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, it's a personal decision. Like, it is something that I wanted to make sure that people like himself and other people in important positions in Fine Gael were aware at least of my thinking. So when I came to a decision, they wouldn't be surprised. And this really did crystallise just a few weeks ago, but I've been thinking about it for a few months. Mm-hmm. And he was aware of that.
Fine Gael haven't had an easy time of late. I mean, was it said to you in the course of your deliberations by the party leader, the timing isn't great here, you're giving us a headache that we don't need?
Well, I would love to think that I'm not replaceable or something, but in this job, as in many others, there's people waiting in the wings to come in and take your place. People who are very hungry and they've got good ideas. And politics should be about that constant renewal and refreshment. I know to some people who are political observers, the idea that someone might only do 12 years and only in inverted commas. Actually, as I see it, was a very good stint, but also I think politics in Ireland, there should be more moving in and out. Mm-hmm.
You were a very important moving part in Leo Varadkar's election to leader of the party. Mm-hmm. You were Minister for Housing. Then after the last election, you weren't a minister anymore. did that impact your relationship with him and your view of yourself within the party?
No, not at all. I've always had a very honest and open relationship with Leo Varadkar. That's how he does business, actually, behind the scenes. And that's how he does business in public life as well. But no, I mean, at the time, you know, we came through the election. It was a tough election for Fine Gael. It was a tough election for me. And then we were straight into the COVID pandemic. And so I was a part of that first response. And that was really important work. And every minister had a different part to play. And then the negotiations to form a government. And I was in the negotiations. And I was very well in those, well aware in those negotiations that I was talking to the future Minister for Housing when I was talking to some of the Fianna Fáil people in the room. And I was trying to get, you know, get some of my advice and my insight and my wisdom to them, because I knew I wouldn't be a part of the housing team.
Did you know that before the election, that you wouldn't be a minister?
No, I mean, going into that election, I think we had very different prospects for our success internally. We thought we were going to have a different outcome. So no, I didn't know that. I mean, I'd had 3 years, no, I'd had less than 3 years at that time. But by the time the new government had formed, I had a full 3 years, and I had a lot more that I wanted to do. And I had all this experience, and I had, you know, the relationships built up, and I knew what was working, I knew what wasn't working. We had in our manifesto some really important stuff still to do, and I wanted to drive that on. But things very quickly changed when we saw the election results.
You had a torrid time in housing. Would you say that's a fair description?
It was a very challenging brief. I mean, it's a huge department. It's not just housing. It's planning, it's local government, it's severe weather events, it's electoral reform, it's the holding of elections and referendums, it's, you know, marine planning and the foreshore, it's our fire services. I mean, it's a very interesting department, and there are lots of pieces to it. But absolutely housing, because of so many people were in crisis, you know, was a challenging brief to try and get things fixed quickly enough to help those people.
Yeah, you seem to be the focal point, though, for anger. And at one point during the election campaign, during the election count, you were heckled, weren't you, at the count centre, and the Gardaí had to be called.
Yeah, but actually that wasn't the first time that had happened to me, because at the local elections, when I'd gone along to check in on the Fine Gael candidates, the same thing had happened. And I was used to that. And I think that's part of the job. I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't bother me, but when you're the Minister for Housing in a housing crisis and you're making decisions that affect people's lives, or if people feel that you're making the wrong decisions or you're leaving them behind, they're going to have a problem with you. And I think when it comes to politics, criticism is absolutely fair. You've got to hold public people to account. When it comes to getting, you know, personal abuse, I don't like it. Who likes that? I understand it too, because people are hurting and they see you as not.
Are you being a politician now saying that? Because you're not a politician anymore. And if this really got to you, you are allowed to say it. You've just given yourself permission at 9 a.m. to say this was a horrible way to live.
No, it was tough. It was tough. But it was like, you develop coping mechanisms. A lot of miles spent out on Sandymount Strand running at night when I get home from work to, you know, when you'd had a difficult day. It's got absolutely nothing to do with why I'm leaving. But I think it's a discussion that we should have in Irish life, because, you know, while I did get abuse, the people around me got abuse as well.
And your family?
Yeah. You know, a previous girlfriend of mine used to get the most horrific abuse to her face in public. And that's not on. And I talked to my colleagues in the Dáil, and I, you know, some of the women politicians, and Holly Cairns, actually, just because she was speaking about it at Christmas, about the abuse that women are getting in politics. Like, you know, there's something that needs to be discussed, because I think maybe you might have been discussing the Constitutional Convention recently, or I was listening to something on the radio. Mm-hmm. And I'm all for quotas. I really support quotas to get more women candidates.
Katie on Saturday was talking about it.
Sorry, I beg your pardon. You know, and I'm all for quotas and we should support them. But unless we have a bigger conversation about this, we aren't going to be able to attract women into politics, or maybe even new people. But it's got nothing to do with why I'm leaving. I mean, I understood that part of the job in the crisis was to make decisions that not everyone was going to be pleased with. And I knew that that would come with then criticism. And that's part of the job. That's how I saw it.
How did the people closest to you react when you were getting heckled, the guards had to be called, things were being said to you on the street?
They get upset. They get upset, you know. They get very protective and they get upset. And that's a very kind of sweet thing to see, and people around you, that they care for you. You know, anyone who's in politics, whether you're in Fine Gael or in Sinn Féin, you're there for public service. You're there because you believe in the public good and you want to try and drive that in a particular way. And we may disagree with each other, you know, like, oh no, Bryn and I are constantly kind of going at it on the housing stuff. But we also agreed on things as well. And if you were a political nerd and watched the committee debates, you'd see us agreeing on amendments and that kind of stuff as well. You know, it's important that politicians can have disagreements, without either themselves or the people around them falling into this kind of tribalism, where because I don't agree with your idea, I therefore hate you and want to, you know, destroy you or whatever. But so I understood the criticism at the time. It was part of the job. It wasn't always nice, but that's it.
That's former Housing Minister and Fine Gael TD for Dublin Bay South, Owen Murphy, telling Clare Byrne the reasons why he's decided to step down as a TD. An Institute of Chartered Accountants Ireland online exam last Saturday had to be scrapped because of what the Institute described as significant technical difficulties. Michael was one of the people who were sitting the exam. He spoke to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline.
Now, Michael, first of all, I think you're very brave speaking out, because I've been told about this and we got calls about this fiasco on Saturday, yesterday, and a number of people said to us, now, they could be misplaced. They're saying, I don't want to go public because I want to become a chartered accountant and I don't want to be seen to be criticising Chartered Accountants Ireland, who are the only people in Ireland that can decide if I become a chartered accountant. What happened on Saturday, Michael?
Well, I suppose, first of all, thanks, Joe, for having me on. Yeah. And just with regards to the other things you kind of led into it, my issue is primarily the exam. So on Saturday, we sat an exam, or we were meant to at the very least. It is to represent 15% of the final exam, which takes place in August.
Yeah.
And it is, you know, as everything these days, all online.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's about 11, somewhere between 11 and 1,200 people sitting it.
Wow.
And there was a lot of kind of technical issues. You know, people couldn't get into the exam. I was lucky enough. I was booted out of the exam for maybe 10, 15 minutes, which when you're watching the timer count down can be very stressful. It's very distressing event. And some people were locked out for about 50 minutes. Well, I believe some people I don't think actually got in. And we received an email while some people were still sitting the exam that the exam had been abandoned.
Do you mean abandoned to be resat or scrapped completely?
Well, the initial communication we got was that the exam was to be abandoned. And we received further confirmation yesterday that this exam has been, there will be no resit. The exam in August will be counted for 100% of the final exam.
Wow. So the exam, the subject on Saturday was what? The aspect of chartered accountancy was what?
It would have been financial reporting.
Okay, really?
Financial reporting.
Well, again, pretty important in given what we've been through in the last 20 years about accurate financial reporting and ethics and above all, the ability to do it properly. So if my best subject was financial reporting, and I've been studying, you study for a year, it's over a series of years, isn't it, to become a chartered accountant?
Yeah, you go through your undergrad. I did a master's, and just for context on this exam, like I started studying, like a lot of my colleagues now, we started studying in early January. I would have been studying either before or after work, maybe for anywhere between 40 minutes and an hour and a half, almost every day, maybe by Friday. I would study every Saturday then, and more Sundays.
So when did they decide to abandon it completely? In other words, they've no way of measuring how good this year's exam class are, 1,200 or otherwise are on financial statements, because the whole thing was just thrown in the bin.
Well, the final exam typically has about 15 of the 85% relating to financial reporting, so it would only be that portion, And, it was, I suppose, abandoned. Like, I understand it was a difficult position for them to take. Like, I am sympathetic towards that, but it's a difficult position to be in as well.
Yeah, now we have a long, I've just been handed this long, long statement from Chartered. Would they not, like, there's enough of them in there. They say they're brilliant, brilliant people, which I'm sure they are. Make sure you're accounted as a chartered accountant. Have they all taken a vow of silence? If I get a break, I'll try and do an exam on that topic and that press statement they've just sent in. It's called, program's called Liveline for a reason, and it's to try and let people, this story has not been in the public domain. One of the reasons is people we discovered yesterday when they phoned us were too nervous because Chartered Accountants Ireland have the monopoly on who becomes a chartered accountant. Now, could I make an analogy, Michael? And it's the Leaving Cert. And I know, by the way, your final exams in Chartered Accountants are much more important in terms of your career and your qualifications than your Leaving Cert, which is a general exam. But is it as if I went in to do an English in my Leaving Cert? And it's my best subject, by the way, this, I think.
Yeah.
And halfway through the exam, we're doing it online, halfway through the exam, it's abandoned. After it looks like things got difficult, I'm worried. I'm wondering, am I the only one that's having difficulties tech-wise? But then they say, no, we're not sitting. You're not going to sit the English exam again. Your Leaving Cert is going to be based on the other five or six subjects.
Yeah, no, that would be reasonable to say, but I think on that, I think with COVID and everything like that, like a lot of exceptional circumstances, you know, have arisen that you wouldn't have thought of before. But to be honest, like in terms of what happened on Saturday, kind of, you know, spilled milk at this point. You know, I'm not going to get those study hours back. But what I would like is for the summer exam and for all chartered exams that, you know, you'd like to hope that nobody has to experience that. Like the thought that you were the only one having the issues.
Yeah.
Extremely distressing. And, you know, it was very upsetting. You know, like it means an awful lot when you're involved in it. You know, you spend a lot of time and, you know, there's a, you know, there's been a lot of tears over the last couple of days over it. Like, extremely distressing, you know.
That's Michael talking about his experience of the Chartered Accountants Ireland online exam, which was abandoned on Saturday after significant technical difficulties were experienced. Michael was talking to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline. Former Master of the National Maternity Hospital, Dr. Rona Mahoney, spoke this morning to Ryan Tuberty, and after discussing their mutual love of history and the state of the world today, they referenced Anthony Hopkins and Dylan Thomas from earlier in the programme.
I love Dylan Thomas, you know. I was just thinking, actually, when you're reading that poem, you know, I was just thinking of his, you know, when he says that, you know, lovers may be lost, but love is not, and death has no dominion. That, for me, is one of the most beautiful quotes.
Yes.
Because I think that it's like life, you know, life can be lost, but life will go on. And that's where our focus has to be, and how we honour death in some ways is to live well while we can.
But precisely. But I suppose in some ways, and I'm going to go back to the other end of the chronological spectrum in a moment, which is your bailiwick, as it were. But but just listening to what I'm kind of processing, what listening to that beautiful poem, spoken so beautifully by him, is that a man of 83, and an actor, an Oscar winner two times over, couldn't finish the poem at his father's tombstone a few days ago, because, and my question is this: you would think, would you not, that we would be prepared for the inevitable? We don't appear to be ever. We know it's coming. We don't discuss it because it's just ugly. But look at his upset at thinking about his father and the end, and he's on his own. He's 83. He knows what's coming.
Yeah, it's phenomenally difficult. I mean, I've recently lost both of my parents.
Yeah, my condolences to you.
Yeah, and it really surprised me, actually. I mean, obviously, you know, you think as a doctor particularly that you are somehow at peace with death. You understand that this is inevitability. You understand sort of where it fits into life. And my parents had wonderful lives. They were both 84 and they died. They were really dynamic people. You know, they were always busy. They had fantastic friends. They really enjoyed life and they gave a lot. They were great contributors in terms of, you know, their work with St. Vincent de Paul, their work in, you know, my father with Cooperation North, ESB. They loved everything and was always involved in something. Loved current affairs, actually. You'd have loved to chat to him, you know.
Yeah.
He watched every single news program that ever existed and every current affairs program, and the newspaper was just a daily joy for him. You know?
And was he your consigliere?
He was, very much. I was very close to him. I mean, we talked every single day. I would get an update. You know, from Maywood, which is where I grew up, you know, the Maywood update on what was happening in the world. And he was just so phenomenally interested. So when he died, I think I was really bereft. And in the beginning, you kind of go back to work and you bury yourself and all that. But at some point, there comes that realization that you have lost, you know, your initial family. And I think I find it very much in winding up my family house. And I didn't expect that. There's so many memories, and that part of my chapter is done, and I'm kind of setting forth now, you know what I mean, as the older generation. And I particularly thought, as you know, my brother died also quite young at 42, and he didn't want to die, and that was a very difficult time.
God, that is
to have those conversations you would, you know, we would acknowledge that he would die soon, and he would sort of be on parallel tracks. I will have cancer treatment, I will get better, I will rest and get better, and then one day, just 10 days before he died, he said, "That's it. I can't do this anymore, I'm too tired." And it was quite a conversation to have. I remember walking out into the street and everyone's carrying on as normal, which is a good thing, actually. And I was very comforted by that. But that extraordinary sense of the conversation I just had and what it actually meant. You know.
Did you say goodbye to him?
I did. I asked him to haunt me, actually.
Did you really?
Not in a bad way. Nothing that would harm me, of course.
No, you mean a happy haunting, right?
A happy haunting, okay. Yeah. You know, that'd be helpful. Helpful haunting.
A helpful haunting, even better. Yeah, okay. Did you really? You had that dark humour twist.
We did. But he'd been so funny. He didn't drink any alcohol while he was sick. He was sick for 2 years. He had a brain tumour. So we knew from the outset that he wouldn't make it. And, I mean, everybody tried so hard, but it was the type of tumour that you don't come away from. But he wanted to have every edge to live as long as he could and to live well. So he was very fit, you know, trained, ate beautifully, and wouldn't drink anything that might have impaired his ability to live longer. But about 10 days, he decided he wanted some beer because he had acknowledged that that was it. But of course, he didn't just want any beer, being my brother. It had to be craft beer. So I'm wandering around Black Rock, you know, on a Friday afternoon looking for craft beer.
Yeah.
Back in the day, this was years ago when there wasn't so much. So I remember thinking, why couldn't he just want a can of regular Heineken for the... Now, it was a very precious conversation, but a very difficult conversation. And I think these conversations are important because I think it can be very lonely for people when they are dying that nobody is able, perhaps, to acknowledge this and to speak of it. And everybody wants to brush under the carpet and say, "You'll be fine," you know, but sometimes that's not the right response. Sometimes it's healthier to be with someone and to let them express what it is they are going through, because it's a lonely business, you know. It's probably the loneliest thing ever, isn't it, to be dying, and nobody can really stop this happening.
Your mum died in October, I'm just wondering about this idea of the house, which has becomes a sort of, and I say this respectfully, but it's like a mausoleum to your past and to your parents and so on. Were you surprised by what items you picked up struck you more deeply than others?
I mean, I think for me it was absolutely, it's the funny things, like, well, obviously books, because my mother read, you know, 5 books a day. And there's so many favourite books. You know, I'm just rereading Brideshead Revisited at the moment, you know, and it just takes you right back to growing up and all the lovely books we had. And the funny things, like, I mean, I'm completely, as everyone knows, cannot cook. But, you know, you'll find that there's this stew dish or something that just reminds you so much of the comfort of a good meal on a cold day. And so it is, yeah. And then there'll be a picture, obviously, that will bring back memories, or a photograph, chair, you know, places people used to sit. And then, you know, their garden, really. It's actually the robins. The robins are still faithfully living in the garden. My parents love their garden, and it's come into bloom now. It's beautiful. But I think sometimes you look out the window and you see the robins, and, you know, you sort of wonder, God, are they looking for my parents, as I am, because you're looking all the time when you're at home for signs of them and to remember them and for them to be present in your life. And I suppose that's the time when you begin to turn that corner, when you can enjoy those memories and enjoy being with them and feel them close and know that they're gone.
I thought that, in my ignorance, I thought that as a medic who sees a lot of, let's call it darkness, but it actually is just fact, if you want to call it that, which is end of life and death, let's face it, and sometimes horrible death. As a medical person, I thought you might be better equipped than somebody like me to handle something as profound as the loss of a parent or a brother.
Yeah, so did I. And, you know, obviously from a technical perspective, you deal with it on your doctor level and you understand clinically what the scenario is. You know, so I would have understood my brother's situation. And equally, my mum died of a lung cancer. It had gone to her spine and left her paralyzed. So I would have understood the clinical implication of all of that. And actually, that is helpful. And there is perhaps, you know, an acceptance of this, and you realise as well that you're not alone in this. You know, you've seen so many families going through this and so many patients, and actually so many patients came into my mind because you remember what you've been through. So you do feel like you're joining, as people say, you're joining a sort of a club, but you are joining a shared experience, and you're very aware of that. Perhaps you've had more opportunity than most to be so, and that is definitely helpful. But at the same time, it's sort of interesting, and it's so physical and visceral, you know.
Yeah.
I always remember, you know, Gabriel Garcia Marquez has a brilliant quote about how you feel it in your stomach and you feel it in your heart and you have that sort of pain. And I remember having chest pain and wondering, like, was I going to have a heart attack? But actually it was that visceral reaction. So
broken heart, really, isn't it? Yeah.
You, no matter who you are, you love people. And you hate to be without them, and you hate to say goodbye to them. And that's just universal. No one is any different. Life is a great leveller. It really is.
Dr. Rona Mahoney, former Master of the National Maternity Hospital, talking to Ryan Tuberty this morning. Who owns the legacy of Michael Collins? That was the question Claire Byrne posed to historian Dermot Ferreter. As we face the centenaries of the end of the War of Independence, the negotiation of the Anglo-Irish Treaty, and the beginning of the Civil War.
It's inevitable that there's going to be something of a battle or a contest to claim the mantle. This has gone on since the beginning of the state, since the foundation of the state. I remember when I was looking at the commemoration of 1916 for the 100th anniversary, and I came across an editorial that was published in the 1930s in one of the Irish newspapers that suggested it was always unseemly, if not indecent, when political parties engage in a figurative scramble for the bones of the patriot dead. So you should expect an updated version of that. In a sense, Collins belongs to various parties, or he belongs to none of those parties. You know, you've got to remember that Fine Gael was formed after the death of Collins, as of course was Fianna Fáil. The Sinn Féin that we have now is the fifth iteration of the Sinn Féin party since its establishment as a movement in 1905. So, you know, if you're looking at it in that strict academic sense, you could say that none of them have a right to claim the legacy of Michael Collins. On the other hand, of course, he does represent the legacy of that contested period, and the parties, of course, arose out of the divisions of that period that he was centrally involved in and is always going to be associated with. So inevitably, they are going to be looking at who can make the best claim.
Yeah,
and that's been going on for decades.
And look, it's as the debate is as heightened now as it ever was. I was reading John Lee in the Mail saying that apparently Leo Varadkar has told his colleagues that the party is planning something significant for the Collins 100th anniversary. And then a source in Fine Gael said that Sinn Féin are not so keen to commemorate the army and the Gardaí. They can't just cherry pick, they have to take them all. Then Fine Gael saying, or Sinn Féin rather, saying about Fine Gael that they should be, they are the representatives of the rump of the Home Rule Party, and their icon should be John Redmond.
The cherry picking has always been a part of commemoration. There's always been a compartmentalisation. What suits us at a particular point in time? And this is where the Collins legacy and the life of Collins, I suppose, lies somewhere suspended between myth and history. It was a point that David Putman, the film producer, would have made when he was speaking at Béal na Blah in the early part of this century, where he was talking about the complications around the legacy, because bits of Collins can be claimed by different people at different stages. And then there are periods when it's very quiet during particular decades about Collins, because his legacy is complicated, and it's not just complicated or difficult for his opponents and the idea of his death representing such a death of the Republican dream. It's also complicated for those who are his biggest champions, in the sense that even in the 1920s there were those on the pro-treaty side who were vulnerable to the charge that they were not fulfilling the legacy of Collins, that they weren't moving quickly enough to prove his assertion that the treaty would be a step to greater freedom. And there are others within Fianna Fáil who would suggest that there was a Collins wing in Cumann na Gael that was interested in republicanism and social justice, and it moved over to Fianna Fáil. Those supporters moved over to Fianna Fáil in the early 1930s because Fine Gael wasn't doing enough to deliver on the promise of Collins. And then what is the promise of Collins? That's where the myth-making, of course, is very relevant as well.
And do we have the answer to that question?
No, I mean, he becomes a blank canvas because of the myth of the lost leader, because he was cut down at such an early stage, that you can paint whatever idealized image of Collins you want onto that blank canvas. And again, you can rally the name of Collins or the legacy of Collins according to the particular project of the time. But even in 1924, when there was mutinous conduct by army officers at a time when the state was still so fragile, they claimed that the reason why they were so unhappy was because the government wasn't doing enough to deliver on the legacy of Collins. The same government, of course, that had championed Collins and what he represented. So it was complicated for both sides of the Civil War divide. And even in the 1930s, the Fianna Fáil government kind of grudgingly accepted that they needed to have make some contribution to the legacy or the memory of Collins. There was, for example, a bust of Collins by Albert Power in the 1930s that found its way up to Dublin. And that was funded by a Fianna Fáil government at the time. And even when Sean T. O'Kelly was president in the 1950s, and of course he represented the other side of the Civil War, he was very taken by a sculpture by Seamus Murphy. And he organised a fund for it to be bought so that it could be put into the Municipal Gallery in Dublin. And even in 1965, Tom Barry, the Cork Republican on the other side of the Civil War divide to Collins, he actually unveiled a memorial to Collins in 1965, and he said, let's bury the past dissensions. So sometimes there were examples of a thaw, I suppose, in that war over the legacy of Collins.
Yeah, but when Fianna Fáil were very successful in the 1930s onwards, it was maybe easier to affect that thaw, would you say?
Absolutely. And in many ways, De Valera eclipsed Collins because he stayed around for so long and he was in power, and he was ironically able to prove the veracity of what Collins had argued about the treaty, that it could actually be a stepping stone to greater freedom. That was very difficult for supporters of Collins and Fine Gael to stomach, that it was ultimately De Valera who proved him right. And De Valera was prickly and sensitive about Collins, and he could be quite mean, because when the Collins family in the early 1930s wanted to erect a monument over the grave in Glasnevin, the Fianna Fáil government was very mean about it and said that they had to have the veto over the inscription, and there couldn't be any public fundraising, there couldn't be a public unveiling. So there's certainly a sensitivity around it, particularly during those 20 years or so after the Civil War.
So what about the impact then of the Troubles from the 1970s on his legacy?
Oh, well, this is where the compartmentalisation was so obvious. For example, the Attorney General in 1973 was Declan Costello, and he specifically referred to the most important part, he said, of the Michael Collins legacy were his outstanding moral qualities. So you don't mention the guns, you don't mention the violence, you don't go into that theme of the bloody birth of the state. You focus on the civilian tradition, you focus on the politics and what supposedly were the outstanding moral qualities of him. And obviously there were wider ramifications for memorialisation and commemoration arising out of the Troubles. But certainly there's a degree of quietness, I suppose, around Collins and his legacy during that period. And then it's resurrected again at a later stage. This year marks the 25th anniversary of the Neil Jordan's Michael Collins film, the Hollywood treatment of Michael Collins. For some people, this was their first introduction to Michael Collins. Mm-hmm. And I was looking at something that the historian Anne Dolan...
I was an extra in that film.
Were you an extra? I mean, you remember.
I was a reporter for a local radio station, and it was being filmed in Bray at the time. So I was asked to go and cover the Croke Park scene. I had to be an extra to do that.
Yeah, but there was a great sense, even, you know, that appetite to be involved. There was a great sense of this being a national event.
Absolutely, and a great pride in it.
There was a great pride in it, but it also raised this question. The historian Anne Dolan raised this point that the original publicity poster for the Michael Collins film had him holding a rifle, but it was changed then to Collins, the passionate politician, the statesman who had made the compromise, making the case for politics. So it fit the peace process theme of that 1990s period, the burgeoning peace process, that this was about a move away from violence towards politics. And Neil Jordan was quite explicit that that was the message of the film. But it also raised questions then as to whether it made a cartoon villain of Eamon De Valera in order to build up Michael Collins. And Alan Rickman, who you'll remember, who so memorably played the part of De Valera, he gave interviews in which he said, you know, I was trying to make the case for De Valera not to be depicted in this way. He said, but you'd need 12 hours really to do justice to the complexities of that period. It's one of the challenges, of course, of bringing history to film.
Historian Diarmaid Ferriter talking to Claire Byrne about the legacy of Michael Collins as the centenary of the end of the War of Independence approaches. They say you should never employ a cowboy to do work for you. But 11-year-old Jesse James from County Meath spoke to Ray Darcy on the phone this afternoon about how he started a business.
Now, the reason we want to talk to you today is you were stuck for a bit of cash and you started a business. So what did you need the money? What did you need the money for, Jesse?
Oh, well, me and my cousins was out playing and we were hungry and we wanted a chipper.
Right. What did you want from the chipper?
We wanted a burger and chips.
Okay. So you went to your mum and you said, "My cousin and I are hungry and we want a burger and chips." And she said,
"No."
Right. Look at all that food in the fridge. We've all heard it, Jesse James. We've all heard it in the past. So what did you decide to do?
We decided we'd go outside and look and see what we could do to get money.
Right.
And I just remember I seen my granny the day before feeding the birds. So I remembered we had a bit of leftover timber from building the extension. And I asked Mum, could I have it?
Yeah.
And we had a hammer and a saw and a drill. And we used that and we built four of them and went around selling them.
What, you built what? Four what?
AM board houses.
Aha. And you built it from scratch. You just, that was, came out of your head, did it?
Yeah.
So you built them yourself and your cousin. Who did you sell them to?
We went round selling them to the neighbours. The first three I sold them for a tenner.
Right.
And I thought I was going too cheap because everybody just said yeah straight away.
Yeah.
So the last house I sold it for 15.
They're going to be listening to the radio now, Jesse James. They're going to go, your man's a bit of an outlaw there. So you sold them all, and did you build any more then?
Well, on the way back, I got a load of orders. I met a woman on the road and she ordered one.
Yeah.
And by the time I got to the house, I had 11 more orders.
Wow. At €15 a piece?
Yep.
Right. That's big money. What did your mum think of all this?
Well, she laughed at us whenever we were going off because she didn't think we'd even sell any of them.
It's become a business now, hasn't it? So you're branching out, excuse the bad pun. So did you finish making the birdhouses?
Well, we used the money we had home to go and buy timber to finish off the rest of them.
Right. And what happened then?
Yeah. And then we were able to get the takeaway that weekend.
What did you get? Did you go for the burger and chips?
Yeah.
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. And then you got a feel for the carpentry and I suppose the selling on. So you became a little bit of a carpenter entrepreneur. And what did you decide to make then?
Well, I thought it was going to be a good idea. So I said I was going to think of something else to do.
Yeah.
So I thought of the wheelbarrows and...
I'm looking at them here. So
it's
a sort of a miniature wheelbarrow that acts as a flower pot of sorts. Is that it?
Yeah.
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 And where did you get the design for that, Jesse James?
Oh, well, I sort of thought of about a flower pot.
Yeah.
Like something that'd be nice for Mother's Day and Easter. And then I was like, a wheelbarrow'd look cool.
Right.
So I decided I'd make one and Mum said it was lovely, so I kept making them then.
Yeah. Now, of course, with the expanding business, you needed new tools and you needed a bit of investment. Who invested money in the business?
Well, more so I did myself.
Right. But did you get a loan from your mother?
Oh, your mum gave me a loan to get a nail gun because Mother's Day I had 30 to make and Easter I had another 50 to make.
Wow. How much were you selling the wheelbarrows for?
Well, mostly just for the neighbours and aunt advertised them.
Aha, on Facebook. But how much were you selling them for? How much were they?
They were €20.
Right, okay. So you got 5...
50 and 25 full.
Right. Oh, so, and who was helping you out? So your auntie was advertising on Facebook. Your sister Rebecca, what was she doing?
Yeah, and then my granny and my mum was, helping me do it.
Okay, okay. And what was Rebecca doing, your sister?
Oh, she was the sweeper.
Oh, she was the sweeper, right. Right, okay. So what? I believe you treated the family then to a takeaway with your with the profits.
Yeah.
With some of the profits. What did you get?
Well, we all just got something that we liked. We got an Indian.
Right, really. Right. Lovely, lovely. So what's the plan next then?
Well, I'm making wooden crosses for the graves now.
That's the next thing, right, okay. Good.
And I want to get a trampoline from my granny's house.
Does she, for her, or does she like the trampoline?
No, for us.
Oh, for you, right. Can your granny go on the trampoline?
No, I don't think so.
No. So you're going to get it for her garden, I see. Right, okay. Right.
Yeah.
Very good. What do you want to be when you grow up, Jesse James? I think I know the answer
to
this one.
I want to be a carpenter.
You want to be a carpenter,
I want to design kitchens and everything.
Yeah. And I believe you've been very good at making things since you're a very young age. You were good at Lego.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's so. I'm thinking you've built 80 wheelbarrows, and how many?
I sold more before Mother's Day.
Oh, did you? Oh, did you? Right.
In between.
Oh, right. So there's more than 80 then. You're probably topping 100 wheelbarrows, are you?
Yeah, probably around that.
Yeah. And what about how many birdhouses did you sell?
We had 11 orders whenever we came home, and yeah, we sold 4 that day, and I sold a load from then. So
from then
probably
on.
Around 25.
Right, great. You're brilliant. You're absolutely brilliant.
Fair play, young Jesse James, 11-year-old carpenter and entrepreneur from County Meath, talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon. You want a bookcase? You've got planks of wood? He'll stick them up. Sorry. Now, after 4 long months of training by Zoom in the sitting room, children around the country were once more allowed to go outside and train with their fellow players, as GAA clubs were allowed to have in-person training again. Today with Clare Byrne reporter Evelyn O'Rourke visited Nafianna GAA Club in Glasnevin, Dublin, to find out what the coaches, parents and kids thought about the lifting of restrictions and the return to play.
So I heard the chatter and the fun atmosphere before I even saw it. And I was heading to one of those first training sessions back at Nafianna, which was the under-8 girls at 5:20. And all you could see was this sea of tracksuits and ponytails bobbing like butterflies around the place as the girls raced around, clearly thrilled to be back together again. And of course, sports training for younger people has been on hold since Christmas. So for many of them, it's been 4 or 5 months since they've been out on a pitch. And COVID protocols, of course, have been taken really seriously. The children are divided into pods, self-contained pods, but it didn't matter to them. From the looks of joy and cheers, it was clear they were having a ball. So I got to speak to so many of the players and their grateful parents, and I started with the under-8s as their coaches were putting them through their paces.
Hi guys, welcome back. First night back. Okay, who's excited? Show me one hand up if you're a bit excited. 2 hands up if you're super excited. Both hands up and jumping up and down if you're really, really, really excited. Everybody's jumping just like me. So glad to see you all today, guys. So, what do you think we're going to do today? Do you think we're just going to sit down and have a really boring time?
No!
Do you think we're going to have lots of fun?
Yeah!
Are we going to play some football?
Yes!
Yay! Let's go.
Hi, I'm Felix and I'm turning 8.
Tell me about being back at training tonight. Are you excited?
Yes, because it's fun to be with my friends and fun to learn.
Fun to run around.
Yes.
And you love playing football.
I do. In training. And I was so happy to be back with my friends.
What do you think of coronavirus?
Yuck.
Hi, I'm Hannah. I'm 7 years old. I love about playing football. It's really fun. You make new friends in it.
And did you miss coming here for your training?
Yes, I did.
Really?
Yeah.
And you're not just saying that because your dad's looking at you. You really, really missed it.
Yeah, I really did.
What do you think of the coronavirus?
I think it's terrible.
I agree. I think it's terrible too. But look, we're back training. That's huge.
Yeah, I really didn't miss my friends.
What's it like to have your dad as a coach? Is he any good?
Yeah, because sometimes he's allowed to be on my team.
Now, guys, start off with the solo, okay? So what do we know about the solo? What's our rhyme about our toes? Toes to your nose, with your
Jojo
pose. Well done, well done. So everybody, you grab our balls and we're going to put our toes to nose, okay? On our right foot, okay? So my name is Fergal White and I mentor with the 2013 girls. It's fantastic to be back training. So I'm obviously parent of Hannah here, and Hannah has been waiting for this day for a long time. We've been backyard training for quite a while, but it's like a little celebration here tonight, and you can see it in everybody's faces. It's fantastic, like, you know.
Evelyn also spoke to the chairman of the club, Paul Smith, who was keen to emphasise that the protocols should be adhered to so restrictions don't have to be reimposed.
So, Paul, all I can hear behind me is the sound of happy children. And this is the sound we've all been missing, isn't it? How do you feel this evening?
Absolutely thrilled and delighted that we're all back. We thought this day would never come, to be honest with you. I was saying at our monthly meetings, by the end of this month, we'll get word that we're back. And that was 3-4 months ago. And today has come, thank God. I'd say every WhatsApp group in the club, they were nearly jammed, I'd say, with the amount of traffic. I have a good few kids myself playing, and today was just fantastic. And since the word came in the last couple of weeks that we're definitely back today, the grass has been cut, distancing has been put in place, and everyone's just got themselves organised again for the return to their pods of 15, so it's fantastic. I can't emphasise it enough.
When is the last time these children were here training?
A couple of weeks before Christmas. A good 4 months. A lot of the groups kept a little bit going. Even our nursery, which is the youngest crowd, we kept that going online very successfully and was a credit to all our coaches.
Now remind us of how impressive the operation is here. You've got a lot of members.
We have indeed. We'll be fielding over 200 teams this year, and the only way is up, in particular in our young female participants. It's fantastic.
So finally I caught up with one particularly chatty player representing the boys, and we'll also hear from one of the mothers who said she's just delighted to see both her children back on the pitch.
Hello, I'm Birdie Lyons. I'm 11 and I'm in fifth class. It's brilliant to be back after like 5 months out.
And what is your favourite sport to play?
Gaelic football, I reckon.
Why? What do you love about it?
You don't have to put on a helmet.
You, since Christmas, if you're anything like my house, right, you've been kind of doing your own thing because you didn't have to be anywhere. And suddenly training is back. It's suddenly very busy, isn't it?
Yeah, from like January doing absolutely nothing to April doing training and school all day. It's good though. I feel good about it. It's definitely nice to be back at training.
What did you miss about training, do you think?
Seeing friends that I don't see in school and kicking a ball about.
The word COVID, what do you make of the whole thing?
I think it's just crap. If COVID wasn't here, a lot of things would be different. I don't think anybody's enjoying it.
I'm Karen Granville. My daughter is Marina and I have a son, Joe, and they're playing down here in Nafina. She was a changed girl when she went back to school and so excited. I mean, she was at home bouncing the ball in the house before she came down just to kind of get back into it. I think it's unbelievably important for them, you know.
She loves it. Her face is lit up. She's practicing away there behind you.
I think it's all about just the enjoyment and the rolling around in the grass and everything else.
And the club. People love this club.
Yeah, I've been here now since my older boy was 4 or 5, so I used to help with them as well until they caught on that I didn't know what I was doing. But yeah, so I backed off and came to the younger ones. I mean, even the older boys, I mean, they're back out in their pods, and I heard one of the mentors saying, "We'll be out running like, you know, crazy things on the pitch again, and not just stuck in the back garden, kicking the ball against the wall and on the Zoom." And we have a picture at home with them looking at the Zoom. I mean, it's just not normal.
Can you just describe what it was like to see all those children running around this evening in the glorious sunshine?
I felt I had my freedom back, and they had their freedom back, because even us as parents get a sociable, you know, part of our day from this. I mean, we make friends from it. So when we were going to walk the pitch in the evenings and have a chat and, you know,
Get the steps in.
And the kids, it was really brilliant to look at it.
That's some of Evelyn O'Rourke's report on the return of underage training at Nafina GAA Club in North Dublin on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne. Well, that's it for this edition of Playback Daily. Don't forget you can listen back to all the shows featured on the programme on the RTE radio player. I'll be back with another bigger, stronger, faster Playback Daily tomorrow at the same time. Until then, for me, Neil O'Sheridan, thank you for listening and good luck.